Let's talk.
Let's talk.
John Brown.
Let's talk.
The Uncaged Sky, my 804 days in an Iranian prison. On the 12th of September 2018, British and Australian academic Dr. Carly Moore-Gilbert was arrested at Tehran Airport by Iran's feared Islamic Revolutionary Guards, convicted of espionage in a shadowy trial. She was given a 10-year sentence. Ultimately, she spent 804 days incarcerated in prisons in Tehran. She has told her incredible story in the book The Uncaged Sky. Delighted to be joining me live on the line from Melbourne, Dr. Carly Moore-Gilbert. Good morning to you. Can I call you Carly? Is that okay?
Of course you can. Of course you can call me Carly.
Good morning to you. Just explain what you were doing in Iran before the events unfolded.
I'd actually been invited to come to Iran by an Iranian university. And, you know, I was an academic at the University of Melbourne here in Australia, and an Iranian...
Carly, are you there?
Yes, I'm back. I don't know what happened there. I'm so sorry.
The screen froze, the saying goes, and it always seems to freeze when happens to me all the time. When you've got, you know, you're halfway through a conversation, so you look extremely interesting. So explain to me. explain to me. So you were just saying you had been invited as a guest of the Iranian university.
Yeah, so they invited me and my university agreed that I should go and they paid for my flights. And I was supposed to attend, well, I did attend a seminar on Shia Islam offered to Western academics. So people from Europe, from Australia, from North America, we all came to Iran for that seminar. And it was relevant to research I was doing at the time. I'm a Middle East studies scholar. And it was a great experience, really, until that moment that I was arrested at the airport trying to come home.
So presumably you were on the university campus, listening to lectures, giving talks, etc., mingling and meeting with other Persian stroke Iranians. So nothing untoward. You just thought you were boarding a flight, presumably back to Australia.
Yeah, exactly. I checked in for my flight and deposited my baggage on the carousel and then was approached by a group of about four men in plain clothes, no identification, no badges, nothing. And they just brandished this nondescript looking printout, looked like it had been printed on a home computer from Microsoft Word. And they claimed that this was my arrest warrant. And of course, it was all in Farsi, so I couldn't read or understand it. And maneuvered me away and took me to an interrogation room in the airport where they interrogated me for 5 or 6 hours. And, you know, I'd missed my flight. And in the end, they removed me from the airport and they took me to a safe house in Tehran and they continued interrogating me there overnight. And, you know, I go into more detail in the book, but I was in a hotel for 1 week. The hotel under their control. I wasn't allowed to leave and they would come each day and interrogate me there.
Right.
And then following that 1 week, I was thrown into Evin prison, into solitary confinement.
What was your initial reaction? It must have been one of shock. I mean, you're just presumably thinking, well, I'll get home, I'll feed the cats, I'll do whatever I need to do when I get back there. And suddenly this happens.
Yeah, I was in utter shock. You know, my initial reaction was, this is a colossal misunderstanding. I'll just show them that I'm innocent, that I've done nothing wrong, and they'll sort it out and they'll let me go home. And so it took a really long time for it to actually sink in that I was in deep trouble and, you know, my stay in Iran could be much, much longer than an extra couple of days.
And espionage, obviously you couldn't read what, because it was in Farsi, what the so-called arrest warrant was on about, but why did they think you might have possibly been involved in espionage?
Honestly, I don't think they even thought that. I think they knew I wasn't a spy. That was just something they concocted for purposes of going to court months and months down the track. They were interrogating me about anything and everything. I think it was a shakedown. They were trying to just get as much information out of me as they could. And, you know, either I was a genuine bona fide spy, in which case, great, they can get info out of me. Or most likely, as more frequently happens, I'm just an innocent person caught up in their dragnet. But that's also great because they can get something out of me for that as well. You know, they can extort my government and get some sort of concession in exchange for me as a bargaining chip. So it's a win-win situation for the Revolutionary Guards, you know, and they don't really care if you're innocent or guilty. And espionage was just something they came up with much later down the track.
What was the Australian government's reaction to this? I mean, did you have somebody getting in contact with you, you know, somebody from Canberra? Were they immediately in contact with you, or did you disappear under the radar? And if you did, that must have been even more terrifying.
Yeah, I wasn't in contact with anybody from the Australian embassy for 4 or 5 months. The first time I had a consular visit was after the interrogation phase had ended and they had passed my file to the court system. So for those first few months, I was banned from any contact with the embassy or the Australian government.
Were you travelling alone, by the way, when you were stopped at the check-in or the baggage carousel?
Yes.
Right. So again, yeah. you could, to all intents and purposes, to anybody who wasn't there, you just sort of fell off the radar.
Yeah, I kind of just disappeared. My family knew I hadn't made my flight, and I was allowed to call them from the prison on a number of occasions. So I wasn't allowed to say I was in prison, but they knew something was up. They knew I'd been detained in Iran, and I'm pretty sure the government knew as well. I don't know at what point they found out, but I imagine in the first week or so, my family would have mentioned something to the government.
You said you were put into a government-run hotel, and I presume that is not exactly five-star with a spa, and then moved into a prison in Iran, and obviously that must have been horrendous.
Yeah, I was put in solitary confinement. I spent cumulatively 12 months in solitary, and I was in Iran for 2 years and 3 months. The longest stretch I spent in solitary was 7 months. The first cell was literally a box. It was 2.5 by 2.5 meters, no natural light, no window. The lights were on 24 hours a day. There was no beds. There was no furniture. It was just me sleeping on the floor with zero, nothing to do whatsoever, just sensory deprivation. And basically it was a situation of psychological torture. And it was deliberate because they wanted to break you down for the purposes of the negotiation. So, yeah, I really, really suffered in those initial few months especially.
How on earth did you get through the days, the afternoons, the mornings, the hours, even the minutes? Because with no natural light, with no stimulus from the outside, as you said, sensory deprivation, I mean, it's very easy for people to go, for want of a better word, to go crazy in there.
Yeah, I did go crazy. The first couple of weeks, it was so hard. I felt physical pain from the psychological torment of solitary, because you just bounce off the walls. I mean, you have most people have an active mind. Most people are intellectually curious, and just staring at four walls with nothing to do whatsoever for 23 hours a day was hell. You know, you become your own torturer. You don't need them to come and torture you. You do it. You do the job for them. And it was only after a couple of weeks that I started to develop coping mechanisms psychologically, and my brain kind of slowed itself down and inhabited increasingly my long-term memories, memories of my childhood. And by the end of it, I would just be lying on the floor with my eyes closed, reliving stuff that had happened to me 25 years ago and trying not to notice the passage of time.
You said you were held for 23 hours a day in the cell. So for 1 hour you were allowed out. I mean, was there an exercise yard, or what, was it a much smaller area than that?
Yeah, so I was allowed out for half an hour in the morning, half an hour in the evening, and it was sort of an exercise yard, although it was actually a small balcony, and it was about 10 meters long, and there was a huge corrugated iron fence, so you couldn't see anything. You could just look up at the sky. And, you know, that's one reason why I called the book The Uncaged Sky, because the sky was the only thing you could look at that didn't scream prison, you know. And you would just pace up and down that courtyard for half an hour. I was out there in the snow. I was out there in the pouring rain and, you know, under all, in the beating sun, under all conditions. And that would be an hour for each day. But you'd still be alone. So even though you changed your environment, you were still alone and you were kind of still in solitary.
But you did manage to communicate with other prisoners during that first stint in prison.
I did, and that saved me. You know, the solidarity and friendship and care of other prisoners, just it was what got me through. And we established this kind of illicit note passing network, me and two other cells, and we never saw each other face to face, but we would write. It depended on having stolen pens, and I managed to steal a pen after about a month. And we would write to each other on scraps of paper or scraps of packaging, and we would hide them in that outdoor exercise area or in the communal clothes drying racks. We would hand wash our clothes every few days and hang them on the rack, and we would pass notes via that as well. And also I was able to at one point speak through an air conditioning vent with the cell next to mine every few nights on particular guard shifts. And they spoke English. They enlightened me as to where I was, who had captured me, what was likely to happen, how I should behave in interrogations. They gave me support. They let me know that I'm not alone. You know, having that solidarity really meant the world to me, and it was one of the only things that got me through that really dark period.
And you were, even though you were being held in solitaries for months on end, they were still interrogating you? I mean, what could they have possibly wanted to find? Or was it just a point of their aim just to break you down sort of spiritually and intellectually?
Yeah, they were still interrogating me. I think one reason they try to break you down so much is because they want a false confession. And a lot of Iranian prisoners and foreign prisoners have made false confessions because of this psychological torture. And that's the easiest thing for them. They can make a propaganda clip about it to sell to the local population, put it on TV. They can take the false confession to the judge in the court and get him to sign off on whatever sentence they ask for, no problems. So that's, you know, it's a lot easier for them if they get a false confession. So that's what they wanted from me. They also wanted me, they wanted to recruit me to work for them as well as a spy. And they spent months and months trying and blackmailing me with my 10-year sentence that I, you know, in the end received in court, using that 10 years to try to blackmail me to work for them. So, you know, there were several reasons, in my view, why they treated you so badly. And it was always to try to coerce you and force you into giving them something, whether that be a false confession or agreeing to be recruited by them.
Rather than making a false confession, you know, the prospect of perhaps getting a lighter sentence, you decided to fight back. You staged hunger strikes. Coordinated protests. I mean, how do you coordinate a protest if you are being held in solitary and the only communication is on scraps of paper, sort of furtively hidden and handed over?
Yeah, well, protest, I don't know. It depends on your definition of protest. I had cellmates at various points. I wasn't alone for the entire 2+ years I was there. And we, for example, organized a coordinated hunger strike. We even managed to communicate that to men in the men's unit, which was entirely separate from the women's unit, via one prisoner who had her husband in the men's unit. And we managed to communicate even to the solitary confinement cells that, you know, on Saturday morning or whenever it was, everybody's going to go on hunger strike together. And we're going to shock them that we're all in touch with each other and we're all going to start at the same time and make the same demands. So these were the kinds of collective actions that we managed to undertake in the prison.
I mean, that's incredibly brave because you are, you know, you're in an Iranian prison. You could disappear and nobody would know what happened to you. Was that not a factor? Or did you think, I would rather do this than spend 10 years? And they say a sentence of 10 years, but there's nothing to say we're going to prolong your sentence by another 5, you know, another 4 years.
Yeah, but I had nothing to lose. At that point, I actually escaped from the outdoor exercise facility and climbed up on the roof of the interrogation block for several hours at one point. You know, I was pretty reckless because I had nothing to lose. I didn't care anymore. They'd taken everything away from me that they could have possibly that I valued. And someone with nothing to lose can be, you know, dangerous because you're willing to do anything. And once I understood that the whole thing was a farce, it was a kangaroo court, I would be convicted. They didn't care if I was innocent or guilty. I was a bargaining chip in a diplomatic game. I thought, well, you know, stuff this, I'm going to fight back because at least then I can claw back some shred of dignity for myself and maintain my integrity and, you know, stand up to them. I didn't want to just sit in the corner and be a victim and wait for people to do bad things to me. I wanted to stand up and push back and draw some red lines. So, you know, I did a lot of resistance in the prison and so did others because I wanted to show that I wasn't completely powerless and I had agency.
The protest, the getting onto the roof, that had the effect of getting you moved to an even more dangerous situation in an isolated prison in the middle of one of Iran's deserts. And again, that was where they put the most dangerous prisoners in the country. What was that? I mean, maybe it's a facile question, but what was that like?
Well, so actually you might be surprised to hear that I preferred to be there than in Evin prison because there I wasn't in solitary confinement and I wasn't in a maximum security facility under really, really strict control and strict monitoring. It was freer. It was pretty horrendous. I mean, the conditions were abysmal. The toilets, the sleeping, you know, we were 100 women sleeping together in one room in triple decker bunks. It was very full on. The food, everything. There were gangs there. There were drugs there. There were, like, everything was there. People died there. People were executed there. But I had friends. I was freer. I could join activities and do things. I could practice my Farsi. I could eat what I wanted when I wanted. I could shower whenever I wanted. You know, basic things about day-to-day life that these aspects in Evin prison in 2A where I was, I didn't have. You know, I didn't even have control over my own toothbrush when I was in 2A in Evin. But in this Karchak prison in the desert, yes, it was super rough and super terrifying in many ways. But, you know, I was a bit freer there and I had human interaction and human contact. So I actually preferred it.
You made friendships. You said that you improved your Farsi. Were you struck by, you know, the prisoners who are there, because I would imagine a lot of them, though, it says, you know, it was dangerous criminals, but obviously a lot of them are also have been slung into jail because of the actions of since the revolution.
Yes. There are a lot of innocent people in Iran's jails, including innocent of criminal offences, not just innocent political prisoners or security prisoners. And I actually even got to know a few of the murderers in Karchak prison. And some of them would admit to it and some would say, no, I didn't do it. My husband did it and he pinned it on me. And, you know, often I'd believe them as well, depending on their story, that they were probably innocent of that crime too. The political prisoners really break your heart because they've done something so innocuous and something we wouldn't bat an eyelid at in the West, like removing their hijab in public, for example. You know, uncovering their hair in public could get you, you know, 12 years in prison and 70 lashes or something. And that's just incomprehensible to us where we're from. And some of these women were remarkably brave. And, you know, I really enjoyed getting to know them and becoming friends with them.
When did you get an inkling that your situation might be changing? There might be a glimmer of hope you might get out of the situation in which you were in.
So I knew that the Revolutionary Guards had decided to undertake negotiations with the Australian government for my release, maybe 10 months or so before the actual release happened. And I was hearing gossip, I was hearing hints from people. Then later I was told directly about it and some of my captors even just gave me a heads up as to what was going on with the negotiations. But there were several deals that fell through and were cancelled at the last minute. So I just didn't allow myself to have false hope. And even when the actual deal started to happen and I was told I'm going to be released, I just wouldn't let myself believe it until I saw it. And, you know, it wasn't until the moment that I flew out of Iranian airspace and I was told, you know, we've entered Qatari airspace, that I was able to just take a really deep breath and go, okay, wow, they can't come after you now. You're actually free.
And was it quite quick? I mean, in terms of actually going from the prison, what, straight to an airport, onto a commercial flight, a private flight, a military flight? How were you taken out?
Yeah, it wasn't that quick. It took an entire day to process. I went to the ambassador's residence in Tehran first. And after there being there a couple of hours, I went to the airport. There were a lot of propaganda efforts by the Iranians, both upon my release from Evin prison. They forced me to stand out the front of the gates and in Farsi answer some questions for a camera for a propaganda clip they'd put on state TV later. And then there was like a gaggle of photographers at the airport photographing me. Even this one of them even tried to get into the bathroom with me, you know, like it was terrifying, to be honest. And eventually it was a private plane chartered by the Australian government that took off with me and, you know, Australian officials from Tehran en route back to Australia.
This is going to sound really facile, but, you know, what was it like to get back to Australia? And obviously just being outside, I mean, having been in a prison for 804 days, just the sensory, we talk about sensory deprivation, the sensory overload and the drama must have been huge for you.
Yeah, I remember the first time I went to the supermarket, and it was a huge supermarket with so many aisles, and, you know, it was so bright, and I needed to buy shampoo, and I walked into the aisle of toiletries, and I looked, and there was just so many options, and I was completely overwhelmed and bamboozled by how many brands of shampoo there were, and I was just paralyzed. I couldn't choose, because for more than 2 years I'd had that chosen for me. You know, there was no option. You just got given a bottle of shampoo, and that was that. So I was overwhelmed for a few days at least, I think, by just the normality and the regular life around me.
Regular life, you know, you're back in Australia now, and yet you decide to write this book where you have to go back to that place. And we talk about people going back to quote-unquote a dark place, but you really were in a dark place physically and mentally. And to open up that box, if you like, that a lot of people would keep shut and nailed and buried, must have been a huge undertaking for you.
It was, but I actually really enjoyed it. It was a... not always an easy task writing this book, but overall I think it actually helped me on my road to recovery from this ordeal. I found the writing process therapeutic. It was cathartic in a way. I was able to process and work through a lot of my memories and structure them and analyze them in a way so that I could make sense of what I'd been through. So it was actually overall a positive experience writing this book, and I really enjoyed it. And I feel like writing it has now enabled me to perhaps draw a line under what I went through too.
The other thing, and please don't take this the wrong way, but you came out in 2020 when the world was in lockdown, basically. So for having spent 804 days in an Iranian prison, and please don't take this the wrong way, but lockdown must have been for you pretty much, you know, how to say that, you know, it must have been bearable because of what you've been through.
Yeah, you know, I was on a massive high when I was freed, and I was just ecstatic and enjoying my freedom and getting out and about. And then 6 months later, bam, Melbourne goes into lockdown. And that really was a dampener for me. Like I obviously, being locked inside your own house is just immeasurably preferable to being locked in a tiny prison cell. But still, it was sort of, you know, limiting my movements, limiting my interaction with friends and family. And that was really tough. And, you know, I didn't understand what was going on with COVID. I knew it was happening, but I didn't have any source of information other than the state media in Iran, which was downplaying everything. And I knew nothing about what was going on in Western countries. So it was quite a shock for me too, to see how the world had changed due to the pandemic upon coming out.
And it would be very easy, because a lot of people go, oh, Iran, it's a terrible place. They do terrible things to each other. But, you know, as like, you know, Persians, I went to school with loads of Persians over here, and they are brilliant people. And yeah. You know, don't hate the people, hate the government.
Oh, definitely. The Iranian people are amazing. And they were so warm and hospitable and welcoming and friendly to me, including many of my fellow prisoners. And the government is super nasty and super brutal and cruel, and they deserve better. And I really, really hope that the amazing country of Iran and the incredible people of Iran get the democratic government they deserve in the future, because they are suffering more than anyone else under the yoke of this regime.
And so what's, and I'm going to run out of time, I'm going to do the cardinal sin of what we call crashing the news, but what is day-to-day life like for you now, Kylie? I mean, what is your day-to-day life these days?
Well, I've just published this book, The Uncaged Sky, and now I'm promoting it. When that's over, I really would like to take some time off and just take a break, because as soon as I came back, I've been writing this book the whole time, and you know, I would really like to just recharge my batteries and figure out what I'm doing with my life.
The book is called The Uncaged Sky. It's the incredible story of Kylie Moore Gilbert. Kylie, if people want to find you on the social medias or the website, where can they find you?
Well, you can buy the book on Amazon, and Audible, as well as an audiobook, or anywhere else that you buy books. It's released in the UK tomorrow, the 14th. And I'm on Twitter at K Moore Gilbert.
The book, and it's also going to be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. The book is called The Uncaged Sky. It is an incredible story of Dr. Kylie Moore Gilbert, 804 days in Iranian prison. Kylie, it's been an absolute pleasure and a privilege to speak to you today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
TRE, your voice in Spain.